This is Whitley Strieber, and you're listening to Dreamland, the best program of its kind in the world. Why? Expert hosts William Henry on the secrets of the past, Jim Mars on politics and conspiracy, Ann Strieber on matters of the spirit, and me, Whitley Strieber, on aliens and UFOs and who knows what else. And our weekly science reporter, Emmy winner, Linda Moulton Howe. We say it like it is. We take you deeper down where the real secrets lie. Dreamland, welcome to the edge of the world. Well, this week, Dreamland is intense. It starts out quietly enough, but wait until you get into the second and third segments. Things heat up quite a bit between me and Daniel Pinchbeck. And do read Whitley's journal on the unknowncountry.com website right now to get some insight into just why I was arguing with Daniel about the nature of the visitors and what they are doing here. Then later on Dreamland, Linda Moulton Howe begins a phenomenal two-part series with Jim Mars about remote viewing. We interviewed Jim Mars just a few weeks ago on Dreamland, but we didn't really talk much about his new book, Psi Spies. We talked about other things, but now she gets into and picks his brain about just what he does know about the remote viewing process, and it is awesome. It is really awesome. That's why it's going to be a two-part series on Dreamland. I'm talking to Daniel Pinchbeck, who is the author of one of the all-time great books on 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl, now available in large format paperback, I believe, and Daniel's website is realitysandwich.com. That's realitysandwich.com. Daniel has been a guest on Dreamland quite a number of times, I think two or three times at this point. We first spoke to Daniel about his remarkable trip to Africa, where he experienced Iboga and his book Breaking Open the Head, which was about a really amazing inner and outer journey where he actually went into the heart of hallucinatory shamanism and tried it out for himself. Now, we're back with Daniel. He's just recently returned from Burning Man, and he's talked to Ann Strieber about Burning Man, and he is now going to be talking to us in a whole new way about 2012, because some time has passed since we last talked about 2012 with Daniel, and a lot of things have changed. Specifically, Daniel, it's beginning to look like the environment is collapsing big time. And it seems almost as if it is, by 2012, we're all going to know we're in some kind of an end game. Could you talk to us a little bit about where you are with this idea right now?
Yeah, well, I guess my kind of meta overview of how I present.
Yeah.
Kind of, you know, how we could see this little period we're in right now. I mean, forgetting about the Mayans for a moment. You know, there are three major trends that, from my perspective, seem to be happening. And one is, the ecological crisis that's unfolding. So we're looking at a situation where, according to a lot of scientists, 25% of all species are going to be extinct in 30 years. And that's gigantic. And also, it really may mean that we can't survive as a species because we don't, you know, we're learning how nested and intermeshed together the whole web of life is on the planet. So if there are no honeybees and no butterflies and no, you know, fish in the coral reefs, the whole biosphere may no longer support large mammals. So then we're looking at the acceleration of climate change and all these feedback loops in the climate system that have been engaged. So that's one piece of it. And by the way, I don't think it's an end game at all. I have a different perspective. Second piece of it is the technological acceleration. So we're seeing, you know, the development of all sorts of technologies, military technologies, surveillance technologies, social networking technologies, cell phones, computers. And I think that these technologies are really having, first of all, they're speeding up our capacities to materialize and manifest our projections. And they're also changing the nature of the human self and the human psyche. And in a way, they're de-alienating us, because when you work in social networks and so on, you no longer have this as much of a sense of being so isolated in your individuality. It's almost more like subliminally this awareness of the, how your network of relationships and mediated experiences is constantly reformatting and reinventing the self that you are. So then the third piece, so then you have the biosphere, the technosphere, and the third piece, I guess, would be the newosphere. And in that sense, I think that there's a psychic evolution happening. And in my own life and in the lives of many, many people that I know and interact with, there seems to be an evolution in psychic capabilities, capacities. People are experiencing more synchronicity, more of a sense of like intention leading to manifestation, almost as if the boundary between the psychic and the physical, which used to be kind of so hard and impermeable, is becoming less dense, becoming more subtler in a way, like more and more permeable. So, those are the three like large categories that I think we can look at. And, I've looked at it in many ways in my last book and in the work that I'm continuing to do. And I definitely see that this psychic evolution is a very profound aspect of this transformation process. And one thing that I discuss in my work is if you look at the Hopi Indians, for example, and that they were, you know, did these rain dances to change the local climate. There's a Cambridge anthropologist, Peter Whiteley, who was a skeptical, empirical thinker who lived with them for years, and he talked about how he was almost embarrassed to admit it in his book, that he would go to these rain dances, and sometimes the Hopi would dance for 20 minutes and clouds would gather. It would be a 120-degree day, clear blue sky, and rain would start to fall. So he ended up thinking that they did have these kind of capacities. So from my perspective, you know, what if there are latent capabilities in the human psyche that would allow us to influence climate, environment, transform the world around us? And what if it's only at a really deep crisis point for human civilization that we would be forced to do the work to access these latent powers of the psyche? That's one way I think that 2012 could be seen in a positive light.
We are going to end up in a situation, and in fact we are already well into it, that is in a sense predicted also in astrology because of the we're moving from Pisces to Aquarius, and Pisces is a very contained sign in which the little fish swims in the water and is sustained. And then Aquarius pours out the water, and that's happening. The fish is literally being poured out onto the sands, and in the sense that the Earth is becoming no longer able to sustain us. So let's go a little bit deeper, if we can, Daniel.
I think the question of the Earth no longer being able to sustain us, I think that the Earth will be able to sustain us, and in fact, we will even be able to thrive on the Earth in harmony with the Earth. It's just that now we're going through a transformation in paradigm. And we've inherited this kind of dominator culture ideology that sort of imposes this separation between the masculine kind of dominator intellect and the kind of feminine nature. You know, so you have Francis Bacon, you know, at the beginning of the scientific project, talked about how, you know, we must torture nature until she reveals her secrets. That's a very negative way to begin a big project like the scientific revolution. You know, so I think we're at a point now where new forms of science and deeper awarenesses are coming into play, and so that we can move from a dominator relationship to the natural world to one that really recognizes natural processes and is more connected to things like a biomimicry, like following the flows of nature, the kind of fractal mechanisms that nature uses to sustain itself. Anyway, I just wanted to make that
digression. So you see a change essentially from the Kali Yuga to the Sata Yuga. Is that
yeah, for sure. That's what I would like to
A transformation of like a reversal, the Tao is in the Tao.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this means that there has to be another way of living coming. Mm-hmm. If you could describe for us what in your mind a person would be like in this new state.
Well, I mean, there are all these, our whole logical way of thinking in the modern world is based on dualism. So, for instance, we impose, collective, individualism to collectivism. And I would say that in this next step, we're going to see that those dualisms no longer hold. And actually, the Burning Man Festival, which you didn't make it to this year, is a great example of that. Because one of the things you understand as you're there is that even though it creates a framework where individuals are given the maximum opportunity to individuate and express their like eccentricity, somehow at the same time, the collective kind of format of the whole thing becomes more and more collectivized. So I think there's a false dualism between the individual and collective. So what I would see is the end of that dualism, and really when people are kind of, meshed in with their proper intention and find their right complementary place in a kind of planetary harmonic system, then that dualism is done away. And we have a situation that is, in a way, like a kind of planetary retribalization of humanity, where people find their proper complementary role in the system.
You quote in 2012 quite a number of times William Irwin Thompson, and one particular quote stands out. We are the climactic generation of human cultural evolution, and in the microcosm of our lives, the macrocosm of the evolution of the human race is playing itself out. Which is exactly what our new mythologies, such as 2001, are trying to tell us. Now, something is certainly trying to tell us something. We have in the subscriber section of Dreamland a series of meditations going on that is changing a lot of people in kind of fundamental ways. And that's certainly not the only place in the world this is happening right now. You mentioned earlier synchronicity, increasing synchronicity. People are changing, but at the same time, the massive weight or the power of entropy seems absolutely overwhelming. We're looking at a situation in which mercury from China, from coal-burning power plants in China, is getting into the soils in California, where sometimes 25% of the particulate matter in the air in Southern California emanates from China, where we have an area just in the past couple of weeks that's been discovered in the Arctic, the size of Massachusetts, that has unexpectedly melted. And the story goes on and on and on endlessly. And I just wonder whether or not even the most profound change of spirit is going to be enough. And why do you think apparently that it is? Oh, I'm sorry, Daniel. We have to take a little break. We have reached the first end of the first segment, and so we'll be back in just a few seconds. Subscribers, this is a special notice just to let you know that the 2008 Crop Circle calendars are in. They are, of course, exceptionally beautiful, and subscribers, if you input the coupon code SUBCL, that's SUBCL, you get $2 off. That's right, $2 off on the cost of the calendar, and it's a limited time offer, so do get your calendar now. In addition, if you order fast, you'll get a free 2007 calendar thrown in. It's a great deal, so don't miss it. This is Whitley Strieber. We're back with Daniel Pinchbeck, his phenomenal book, 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl, the finest book of its kind ever written, now in large format paperback. You can get it from us. You can get it from any bookstore. His website, realitysandwich.com. Go to realitysandwich.com. You'll find all kinds of things to see and do there. Project yourself into the future. And with Daniel Pinchbeck is one very, very valid way of doing it. Daniel, before we left the air, I was asking you a question.
I got
you remember the question. Okay, well, let me just remind the audience, if you don't mind. Question was, are we going to be overwhelmed by this entropic catastrophe that is unfolding around us, or not? Are we somehow going to be able to rise above it?
Right. So, that was not exactly the precise question that you asked before the break, so I'm going to go back to the question that I think you did
ask. Okay, well, folks, then you'll just have to go back before the break and listen.
Why I hold, the perspective that we can make this transformation. And I think, there are many different levels of answer to that. And one level is that, you know, I feel that I've made, you know, levels of transformation in my own psyche, and that I've seen other people around me do the same. So I see that transformation is very possible, and positive transformation is very possible. I really like Rob Bresnahan's book, Pronoia, The Antidote to Paranoia, just as a concept, that, you know, you can always look at everything, you know, as dire, conspiring against you, and it's getting worse and worse, and paranoia is, you know, the only option. Or you can look at it pronoically and see that everything is conspiring to give you the most exciting and best experience possible. And I think in a way we are in this kind of like, you know, God has written a good, like, Hollywood plot for us here, you know. And really the question is whether we want to rise to the occasion or not. I mean, for me, I was really influenced by Jose Arguelles, who was one of the guys who really worked through this Mayan stuff in a profound way. And I was talking to him, and he was like, oh, you know, 2009, we're going to start to take down the technosphere, and we're going to go into, you know, garden collectives, you know, telepathic seances. And I was like, Jose, that's totally ridiculous. Like,
yes, it is.
We're about to kill each other and so on. And he was like, look, my job as a visionary is to envision the best possible outcome for humanity. That's my job, you know, and I'm going to keep doing it. And the more I sat with that, I realized that was like a really good job concept, and I was going to take that on as a job too. But in fact, for me, from my perspective, there's a lot of, you know, it's very easy to stay with the negative. It's actually there's like a sort of self-satisfied, and also, you know, it sells well. You know, people like to hear negativity. It feeds their own sense of irresponsibility.
It does, exactly.
From my perspective, you know, transformation is absolutely possible, and it is happening right now, and we are capable, and indeed we are going to transition into a sustainable, compassionate planetary culture. And we're going to take the technical capacities of the human mind that we've now used to create cell phones, iPods, and we're going to turn them into salvaging the biosphere and creating a garden planet. And we're going to start to do that in the next few years. First, there's going to be a breakdown of the current civilizational structure, an end to authoritarianism and hierarchical dominator culture. And then we're going to shift into a sustainable planetary culture. And I think that's going to happen in the next few years.
How will this breakdown take place?
Well, we're seeing it already in the financial sector. I don't know if you've been following the crisis of the subprime mortgage market.
We have indeed on the show.
Okay, so basically what's happening is, you know, we've got an empire that's running out of gas, and there's a classic paradigm here. You have the revolt of the mercenaries. You know, Saddam Hussein, Al-Qaeda, these were our mercenaries. They've gone into revolt. Then you have the outsourcing of all of the productive capacities of the United States. So we moved our factories overseas. We moved even, like, phone services, you know, technical capacities overseas. So then we had this huge population here not really doing anything.
Let's talk a little bit about that fascinating phrase that whipped past in that incredibly dense statement you just made, the revolt of the mercenaries. Could you explain that a little further?
Sure. Well, Saddam Hussein and Qaeda were our operatives, right? We were running them.
Right. In the sense
the
that
CIA,
Saddam Hussein was our surrogate.
Then we had to go get him. I'm using the analysis from a really fantastic book called Multitude by Antonio Negri and Michael Hart, who are political philosophers who, in a sense, could be seen as the Marx and Engels of our time. And they really talk about there's a kind of logic in empire, you know, that when it gets to a certain level, you know, the people no longer want to fight, you know, so you have to have a mercenary army, which is what we now have in Iraq. Then you hire mercenaries to do your bidding. Then when those mercenaries start to revolt, that's the beginning of the end of the empire. Okay, so that's what happened with Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. Now we could also look at, you know, this financial crisis. So basically outsourced all of our productive labor to third world countries where it was cheaper. So we were left with a huge consumer base here, used to a comfortable consumer lifestyle, no longer really contributing anything productive. So what our financial geniuses did is they turned debt into a financial product, and they collected mortgages, credit card debts, and they packaged those into securities based on really insane projections of people being able to pay back huge ballooning interest payments over time. And somehow this, like, just went up the whole financial pyramid. So these securities have now been bundled into all these other financial instruments. And according to some estimates, about half of the speculative capital on the market is completely delusionary at this point.
Yes.
What we're seeing is that the Federal Reserve and the European Central Banks are just having to create credit, money, ex nihilo, tens of billions, hundreds of billions of dollars per week, just to keep the illusion of the financial system operating. So clearly yes. that's not something that can go on perpetually. Okay. So, and when we look at the resource crisis, the peak oil crisis and so on, the sustainability of the current paradigm is not possible. So there is going to be a breakdown. Now, what happens in breakdown scenarios is it could be, you know, return to mob rule, or it could be evolution to a higher order civilizational paradigm. Now, I think it's going to be the latter. And I believe that one aspect of that is the work that's been done on an individual and collective level, you know, over the 40 years since the 60s. I look at the 60s as the kind of first stage and a kind of initiatory shamanic process for the modern Western psyche. And I believe we're now entering the second stage of that process. And we weren't able to do it at that point because we didn't have the tools, we didn't have the elders, we didn't have the wisdom keepers, we didn't have the shamans in our culture. In that time, many, many people have gone through their own individual initiatory journeys. Many people have connected with indigenous cultures and shamans, and there's also been a deeper integration of the Eastern metaphysical perspective into the Western psyche. I don't see that you can see that as a trend anymore. It's actually a major cultural shift. I mean, everywhere I go in this country, I see people reading Thich Nhat Hanh, the Dalai Lama, et cetera, Alan Watt. There's been a deep integration of Eastern mystical and metaphysical concepts into the Western psyche. So I see us as being really actually quite well prepared for a tremendous shift in culture and social paradigm. And I also see that the Internet could play a pivotal role in that. And if you look at the history of media technologies, whenever there's a profound new media technology, it leads to a different form of social organization. You couldn't have had mass democracy without the Gutenberg printing press. The Internet points to the possibility of a global direct democracy orchestrated through the distributed networks of the commons. This is what the book Multitude also discusses in great depth.
And yet the Internet is itself soon going to be very different from what it is now, because just a few days ago, the Justice Department approved the FCC's query as to whether or not it would be legal for the FCC to allow backbone companies, the Verizons and the ISPs of the world, to charge websites for access to their customers. In other words, not only do they get to charge the customer for access to the web, they charge the websites for access to the customer too. And the result of this is going to be a massive decline in the vitality of the Internet.
I personally have to question, I just feel that you have a tendency to harp on the negative perspective. And I have to question where that's coming from. I mean, for me, I sometimes feel in your perspective a little bit of what I talk about in my book as the aromatic, which is the kind of mechanistic and kind of downward moving thrust of consciousness towards minerality, technology, extinction. You know, and from my perspective, the Internet has been designed as a very, very robust system. It was designed by the military-industrial complex so that we would have a system that still worked in the event of a nuclear holocaust, okay? It's a distributed nodal system. I don't think it's, from my understanding, it's not really controllable in the way that the FCC might like it to be. It was created with a fundamental infrastructure that's going to make it very, very hard to control in the way that the, you know, corporate masters might like to control it. But so from my perspective, and also this is something that I really go into depth into my book, you know, where we focus our intention of consciousness, that's the world that we begin to bring into being, okay? So if you're focusing your intention of consciousness on negativity, paranoia, anxiety, those are the aspects of reality that you're beginning to give more weight to and to institute as a future potential. So I would want to put the question to you as to why so much of your focus seems to be on the negative framework.
Well, there was a very interesting story about the Titanic, which is told, I believe, in Walter Lord's book about it, and which was that a gentleman told a lady on the Titanic that it was going to sink, whereupon she slapped him across the face, turned around, and walked in the other direction, whether or not either of them survived, I have no idea. But it is essential to be aware of these dangers. Otherwise, we'll never cross this rapids. And so my perspective is actually a very, very positive perspective, not a negative one.
I haven't
at
heard
all.
Any positivity from your perspective at this point. What do you think? What do you personally think is the whole 2012 transition then? Where do you think we're going?
Well, I see that I've angered you, but unfortunately we've come up to a break, so we'll have to put the gloves back on when we come back. We'll be right back. This is Whitley Strieber. I am talking to Daniel Pinchbeck. His terrific new book, 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl, has been republished in large format paperback. It's available in bookstores everywhere. His neat website, realitysandwich.com. Don't miss realitysandwich.com. We have been having a fairly heated discussion and about fundamentally different approaches that the two of us have to consciousness and the way to go forward. I am not a believer, and I will be frank, in I'm not positivistic at all. I think that that without seeing the dangers ahead or trying to, we can't survive. That it's essential to our lives. But I want to take a different perspective.
No. I'm not quite ready to go off the subject.
Okay.
What do you see as the human future post 2012?
I see, well, since you're now interviewing me, we'll do that for a little while. I see a tremendous decline and dieback of the human species taking place over the next 100 or 150 years.
Okay, so I just
want
to point out that that's your shadow projection.
It'll happen.
I just want to point out that you don't know that it's going to happen, that it's actually your shadow projection. From where we are now, there is enough food to feed the people on the Earth. It's not necessary that that's going to decline to an extent that's going to lead to a huge die-off by 2012. So what you're doing, you're putting out there your shadow projection. Where is that coming from?
Well, I don't think that 2012 is a particularly important specific date.
I don't either. I'm using that as a marker.
Yeah, and me too.
If there's going to be a huge die-off of the human population, I'm telling you that that is your shadow projection. Where is that coming from?
I'm so fascinated with why it makes you angry.
Because you're putting out there day by day a message to a large number of people that there's going to be a huge die-off of the human population in the immediate future. Where do you come off having that perspective? How dare you?
So what you're saying then is the same thing that Darius used to say to the unfortunate messengers. Off with your head if your news is bad.
No, that's not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying to you, what responsibility do you take for saying something that you don't know to be the truth, that you're putting out there there's going to be a huge die-off of the human population? How do you take responsibility for that? What do you know? And I also find it interesting that you would have that perspective considering your communion with entities who, from my perspective, are not wholesome and may not be looking forward to our best interests on this planet.
Well, this is taking a stranger and stranger turn, quite frankly.
Is it?
Yeah, the rage now I hear in your voice that's not just a little bit of anger, but a deep rage and really
almost...
Well,
you're putting out there a message day by day on your show that there's going to be a huge die-off of the human population in the future. Why wouldn't I be a little bit angry about that? You don't know that for a fact. At the moment, there's plenty of food to feed the people on this earth. Why don't we work towards a positive outcome for humanity, what Buckminster Fuller talked about as a win-win situation for humanity, and not project our shadow projections and garbage that we've gotten from entities who are not wholesome on this planet?
Well, I don't know quite why. You have no more idea of...
Well, I know that today there's enough food.
No, you don't. I mean, you don't know any more about what I experienced than I know about what you experienced, and neither one of us knows a damn thing about what's going to happen in the future.
Correct.
Certainly you don't.
Why do you project there's going to be a huge dive of the human population?
And what you're implying is that because I believe this is a danger, that I will make it happen.
Well, you're projecting it. You're
no,
using
I'm not.
Your consciousness to project a negative outcome for humanity. Because you didn't just say you believed it. You said you know it's going to happen. That's a distinction.
I said I thought it would.
When I go through my things, I say there's a thought hypothesis that I'm doing. This is a thought experiment. I do not know the outcome. Certainly, at the moment, there's enough food and enough water to support the present human population.
I don't agree with you at all.
A huge die-off.
Why don't you go to rural China and try to drink some of the water and see what happens to you? Why, if everything is so wonderful, is the Chinese middle class frantically trying to buy its fruits and vegetables from California?
You do not hear me say that everything is so wonderful. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that by saying that you believe or that you know there's going to happen a major die-off of the human population, you're projecting that into the consciousness of the planet. And if you're doing that, you have to take responsibility for putting out some very negative vibes.
At the same time, you have to take responsibility for putting out another vibe, which is perhaps even more dangerous, and that is essentially saying that we need do nothing but sit and meditate and we'll be fine. It isn't true.
Actually, that is completely, I don't even understand where you got that from. That is completely, and I'm just to go through my whole hypothesis of 2012, no, that is the opposite of what I think. I actually think that we have a window of opportunity to catalyze a transformation of planetary culture, and that it requires active work from everybody involved. And I think there's a potential for a system transformation that could lead to a sustainable outcome for humanity, a win-win situation. And it is certainly not about meditating and being passive. It's about activating entirely. And I'm very interested in models like Transition Town in the UK, which is basically 80 towns in the UK right now are having regular meetings to discuss the effects of peak oil and climate change and actually preparing their local communities for these transformations, then working with local government, even bringing in local currencies again. I'm interested in models like that. I'm interested in how the internet can be utilized for really exact shifts in resources. There's nothing in my perspective that is about it just being wonderful or not requiring effort on our part. Entirely the opposite. So it's interesting you don't even know my perspective having read my work.
Well, you don't know mine either or understand it, but you certainly think you do.
Well, you just said
that the entities are supposedly negative. You don't know jack shit about those entities because you've never had any contact with them at all.
I read Communion several times.
You read it, but you didn't read it. You couldn't
quite
have.
Surprised.
Because you have a
red communion, you changed the name from Body Terror to Communion.
Because I began to understand them over time.
Oh yeah?
Yeah, over time I understood them.
Maybe they were capable of manipulating you over time. Maybe part of that manipulation is you putting out a negative message into the human psyche about what's coming up in this transition period.
Well, I think that is obscene. It's not even ridiculous. It's beyond ridiculous.
Well, you are the one who said that it is going to happen, that there's going to be a huge die-off of the human population, and I believe that.
You hear the blame and the anger in this voice?
Shadow material.
You speak about negativity, Daniel. You're projecting an enormous head of negativity because the truth is, and it's becoming very obvious in this interview, you're terrified and I'm not. At all.
I'm not terrified.
I'm curious at me. I'm pointing out to you that,
and then we can change the subject. I'm not terrified at all.
No, I don't want to change the subject now. I want to go on with this.
My perspective is that you have said in this interview that it is going to happen, that there's going to be a huge die-off of the human population.
Yes, I think so.
And you believe that.
I do.
Okay. So you are the one, from my perspective, is operating the buttons.
Look,
the terror,
nature
and the
is
fear and the
nature is numbers. It's nothing. There's nothing mysterious about it. It is simply numbers. There are too many human beings on the planet now. There will not be this many in a 50 or 100 years. What exactly will happen over that time? I don't know. It might be very organized dieback. It might be a very disorganized dieback, and in different parts of the world, it'll probably be unfold in different ways, but it's going to happen because the environment cannot sustain the number of human beings who are here living as they do now. It's as simple as that. It has nothing to do with some kind of lunatic paranoia about negative entities influencing my mind. Back as long ago as 1985, when I published a book called Nature's End, I sat in a room full of environmental reporters and listened to one after another of them excoriate me just the way you're doing now. But if you pick up Nature's End today, which was, after all, just a humble little novel, you will find it reads like a prophecy. It reads as if it was written by somebody today, looking back, not somebody in the past, looking forward. So I don't think that my perspective is so irrelevant or so foolish or indeed some kind of bizarre mind control or whatever it is you may think involving negative entities that don't have the best interest of the human species at heart, which is, I think, it's just about the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my life.
Okay, cool. I do want to point out that we know, none of us know what is going to happen in the future. So to say that we do know is pretty odd from my perspective. And what we do know, I mean, one thing that is coming on the horizon are a lot of visionary new technologies that are being developed, including water-powered cars, including potentially free energy devices, including working with the microbial world, including algae, farming algae for food and for fuel. So there is a potential that the human technical capacities could, taking a different approach, not a dominator approach to the natural world, but a biomimicry approach to the natural world, that we could begin to think our way out of this mess, and we could maybe do it without there being a human die-off of vast proportion. I don't know that that's possible, but I see it as conceivable. I know of, for instance, there's energy technologies that a friend of mine is developing, which basically uses ancient techniques of the Amazon. I think it's called the agrochar, where actually the slow-burning process creates a microbial sheath that sucks carbon in from the atmosphere while it creates energy, and the only byproduct of this process is a nutrient-rich topsoil that can be sprinkled on topsoil and restore topsoil. You know, I know of projects where they're studying microbial processes where the microbes actually eat garbage, stuff that's toxic to our environment, and excrete fuel. You know, so there may be a lot of potentials in how we reactivate our connections to the natural world through technologies and techniques, but not ones that are based on domination, but ones that are based on conciliation and understanding the deeper principles of nature.
Well, that's all very hopeful. And if it had been true that this was taking place, these efforts were being made 30 years ago, they would matter. And I agree that they may even matter now if they're sufficiently robust. But we have to wait and see on that.
Then the other aspect of the situation is the development of human psychic capabilities, which could potentially lead to enormous transformation at a very high rate of speed. And it's very interesting, for instance, David Lynch's work with transcendental meditation, where they've done work where they've shown that a number of TM meditators in an environment can create a peaceful vibration that reduces the homicide rate in a high homicide district. So, for instance, if you had a network of TMers concentrating in peace across the planet, it's possible that vibe could deactivate the homicidal aggression of militarism that's on the planet. I think there are a lot of huge potentials for a very, very fast evolution into a peaceful, compassionate, and sustainable planetary culture without there being a huge die-off of human population.
This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We're talking to Daniel Pinchbeck. We'll be right back. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. Daniel Pinchbeck's new book, 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl. He's also the author of Breaking Open the Head. The Return of Quetzalcoatl is being republished now in large format paperback. Despite Daniel, the book is terrific. And I mean, you laid it down, Daniel. We're not friends anymore, and we never will be. We never really were. But nevertheless, I could not disagree with you more profoundly, as you propose what looks to me like a kind of a miserable fascism on the human spirit and a future that is enormously dreary, even in the unlikely event that it should unfold.
By the way, Whitley, I just want to say that I'm capable of having an argument with somebody and profound disagreements with somebody and still considering them friends, and that I do really appreciate you having me on the show. And I feel
well,
like
I'm glad you
together.
Appreciate having me on the you appreciate being on the show. But I'm telling you right now, when you attack my very being and my spirit by saying that I'm in league with evil entities, as you did say, it's not possible to maintain a friendship under those circumstances, because this is so outrageously untrue. And for those of you who are subscribers to this website, who listen to our meditations and who are involved in this, you'll know how unfair and outrageous this attack that this man carried out on this radio program was. It's just disgusting. And ignorant. Absolutely ignorant. But I don't want to go on about it. We've had our fight. Now let's do something that might interest our listeners a little bit. Speaking of which, in chapter 4 of your book, you begin to talk about the relationship between the black hole at the center of our galaxy and human consciousness in some very interesting ways. And I wonder if you could expand a little bit on what you think that the Mayan hieroglyphs describing this hole in the sky, the cosmic womb, the black hole, through which their kings entered other dimensions, what might that mean to us now?
And by the way, I do apologize. I am sorry that I outbursted in such a fashion. There has been stuff that I've been longing to have a deeper conversation with you about for a long time. I was hoping we would have it at Burning Man before there was any public discussion.
Well, I'm glad now I didn't go.
I apologize that came out in such a way. So what does that mean? The black hole at the center of the Milky Way and the ability of kings to, you know, and shamans to transport themselves through it. It's a good one. I mean, you know, it may be that there's some kind of interdimensional tunnel that we can access. I mean, that was their images of kind of ropes and cords, you know. I mean, I also, I guess one kind of friendly metaphor that I've been trying to, you know, use for it is if you think about this 2012 alignment as a meeting of the sun, first father, and the black hole, cosmic mother, it's almost like we're aligning to get our hug from the cosmic mother at the center of the galaxy. And it reminds me a little bit of Amma, the Indian hugging saint, and the experience one has when one kind of goes and waits and lines up and is put in position, and finally you get this really blissful hug from this fabulous Indian woman. You know, so I see it as in a way this alignment might be, you know, although I admit it looks very bad right now, and there are a lot of negative aspects of our current situation, we still may be lining up for our cosmic hug from the cosmic mother.
Well, hopefully it'll be a much happier experience than the ones the Maya had.
Well, I don't think we fully, you know, I think we make a lot of assumptions about what happened to the Maya. And, you know, one assumption is that, you know, civilization is meant to be permanent. Like, you know, we think we have this American civilization and we're going to go on forever. And, you know, maybe the Romans thought that also. Well, it's possible the Mayans didn't really think like that. It may be that there's kind of self-organization into a civilization was really understood to be for a particular time frame, like a certain length of the Bakhtun cycle, and that when they had completed kind of integrating a knowledge system and kind of manifesting it through their monuments and written work and rituals, that they were done with that process and really almost preferred. I mean, maybe the leaders were, you know, as Arguelles conjectures, avatars from galactic civilizations who went back to their world, and then everybody else went back into an easier to live with tribal scenario. I don't know that that's the case, but I just think that the sort of Jared Diamond perspective that there was ecological overrun and collapse, I don't think the evidence is too good about that. And even if that was the case in one or two city-states, there were dozens of city-states, and some of them were pretty remote, and a lot of them, I don't think there is much evidence for ecological deprivation at that time.
So then it didn't happen? Or what well, did? I'm not understanding your perspective at all.
I'm just opening the question. I don't think that we know what happened to them. I don't think we know why they abandoned their civilization. And it may be that in terms of their society was so focused on synchronization, harmonic temporal patterns. It may be that when a certain Bakhtun was completed, that was the signal for them to give up with the civilizational thrust and return to a tribal culture.
Now, you speak of the 9-story pyramids, the Mayan pyramids, and their relationship to consciousness. It's quite a fascinating perspective. Could you expand on it a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's not my, I just want to say that, like, a lot of these ideas, I mean, I sort of acted as a journalist. I was kind of integrating different perspectives. So, you know, that was, John Major Jenkins was the one who really did the work on the black hole in his book, Maya Cosmogenesis. And Carl Johan Kalaman did the work on the 9 stages of, in consciousness in his work, the Mayan calendar and the transformation of consciousness. But he ended up noting that these nine-stage pyramids and Maya lands could represent a nine-stage process in the evolution of consciousness, and that the Mayan sacred calendar, the Dzogchen, is a 20 by 13 matrix, 260-day count. But this 20 by 13 matrix might have been embedded in this kind of nine-stage process. So it would be a scenario where each of these stages was 20 times faster in linear time, and each of them had a 13-point energy cycle of creation and destruction energies that were connected to different Mesoamerican deities. So the bottom stage of the pyramid, the foundation stage, went back more than 16 billion years ago to the origin of the Big Bang. The next one is around 800 million years ago, then 40 million years ago, then 2 million years ago. So according to Kalman, we're now on the eighth stage of this pyramid, and it began in 1999. So each of the 13 stages is now about 360 days. The seventh stage began in 1755. Each of the stages, the 13 stages, is about 20 years, or less than 20 years. And then the sixth stage began in 3100 BC, and each of the stages is a little under 400 years. There's been this kind of telescoping of evolution and acceleration of consciousness. So according to Kalman's model, we are now experiencing as much growth, as much creation, destruction, evolution, novelty, and consciousness in a little under 1 year that people were experiencing before 1999 in a little under 20 years, and before 1755, in a little under 400 years.
And this is certainly borne out by history.
It seems like an extraordinarily precise kind of measurement, especially when you look at these different thresholds, like 3100 BC, that was the shift into a dominator hierarchical civilization. We abandoned the tribal culture, lunar, great mother worshiping, moon calendar following. Tribal culture. We moved into hierarchical civilization following the father god, the solar, the sky god. And then from 1755, we shifted into industrial revolution. So we began to deal with the power and materiality in a new way. 1999, you could see as the threshold into the global brain through the internet. So I think it's on many levels a very, very interesting formation. I also really like the Peter Russell has a book in a new anthology, The Mystery of 2012. He wrote a book called Waking Up in Time, and he really looks at how these successive evolutions or revolutions of human consciousness seem to happen in exponentially more telescoped amounts of linear time. So you had thousands of years was the agricultural revolution. Then you had the industrial age happened in hundreds of years. And the information age happened in tens of years. So what Peter Russell puts out is that this next evolution or transformation could be what he calls the wisdom age. And it would be built on the information techniques and technologies, just as the way the information was built on the industrial. The industrial was built on the agriculture. And so, we could move from just information, which is kind of like what's happening now if we look at the financial system. We have all these genius hedge fund managers creating computer models, but it's not based on any planetary reality, to wisdom. And wisdom would be, using forethought and foresight, really thinking about sustainability, the planetary environment, what's good for human culture as a whole, and instilling the system with wisdom values.
Do you expect the financial system to collapse?
Well, I try not to expect anything, but it certainly doesn't look too healthy right now. I think there has to be some kind of meltdown seems likely. What form that will take, I don't know. I mean, I've heard, and apparently George Soros was talking to a friend of mine, and Soros said that he felt that even currency would be without value in a few years, and that land would be the only thing that would have value. But I find that, in a way, also a limited perspective, because I think if there is a kind of raising of consciousness about the manipulations of capital. The way that people have gotten that land is also not going to be respected. And what's really going to have value is going to be human relationships.
Well, that's certainly an interesting and guardedly optimistic perspective. And we have come to the end of our time together on Dreamland. For our subscribers, Daniel Pinchbeck will be talking to Ann Streber about Burning Man, a festival that he's been going to for many years that is a very important part of our world and our culture and a place of deep and profound change for many people. So don't miss the subscriber interview between Daniel Pinchbeck and Ann Streber. And there are no fireworks, except I suppose those who that might have gone off at Burning Man in this lovely interview. Next up on Dreamland, we're going to be talking to someone who is not afraid to face reality. In fact, who isn't afraid of much of anything at all. Dreamland's ace science reporter, Linda Moulton Howe. We'll be right back. This week, Linda Moulton Howe begins a two-part series with Jim Mars about his book, Psi Spies, and the whole remote viewing program. See it from the inside. Jim Mars has probably got the best insights into this whole remarkable story of anybody in the world, even many, if not all, of the people who were directly involved. That's how good Jim's research is. Linda Moulton Howe's great website, earthfiles.com. Don't miss a single day. Get the facts that others dare not tell you. Here she is from Albuquerque, Linda Moulton Howe.
Thank you, Whitley. Jim Mars was born and raised in Fort Worth, Texas. Jim has been tracking down facts and trying to make sense of political stories in America since his college days as a journalism major at the University of North Texas in Denton. He graduated in 1966 and began a newspaper reporting and editing career, first at the Denton Record Chronicle, then the Lubbock Avalanche Journal, and the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, where he was an investigative reporter and cartoonist and earned photography awards. By 1988, Jim decided that he had to put his big file about President John F. Kennedy's assassination into a book. The result was an instant classic called Crossfire. 2 months after its release in 1989, Jim received a call from Hollywood film director Oliver Stone, who wanted to option Crossfire for the movie that became JFK. Jim Mars began asking book editors and others what each thought was the next big, deep, dark, secret government cover-up beyond the JFK assassination. Unanimously, he heard an answer, UFOs. As Jim began to nose around for more UFO information, he stumbled onto the government's efforts to produce psychic spies. Spies who would remote view anywhere in the world, even in the skies and underwater and out to Mars and Jupiter, and return with facts beyond the field intel of normal agents trudging through fields, streets, agencies, and corporations. I remember the depressed telephone call that I received from Jim after he thought his Psi Spies manuscript had been accepted for publication and then was canceled for mysterious reasons. He was a celebrated and successful author. Jim suspected there was a deliberate government block to keep the highly strange Enigma files, as they were called, about UFOs, away from the public and media. Frustrated by the block, but determined to keep going, Jim completed his second book, Alien Agenda, which was successfully published in 1997. Alien Agenda raised the question, who would speak for Earth if non-humans finally arrived in public, those UFOs and non-humans that the remote viewers were saying they were encountering. Trying to answer that question led Jim to write Rule by Secrecy, published in 2000. In that important book, Jim Mars made links between the money power elite of America with the money power elite of Europe, all linked back to the money power elite of Mesopotamia, which might have been under the control and manipulation of non-human entities with their own agendas on this planet. By then, Jim realized that he had produced his own unplanned trilogy about government secrecy, cover-up, manipulation, and control. The next year, the Trade Towers in New York City and the Pentagon in Washington, D.C. were attacked. After 9/11, the world has never been the same, and the horror of it all provoked Jim to ask questions about who exactly was behind the September 11th 2001 attacks, and why is remote viewing so off-limits?
9/11 happened, and I jumped on top of that and produced a book called The War on Freedom, which, again, was mysteriously canceled, yet I was paid all of the advance. It's like, take the money and go away. We don't want to hear about this. And that eventually was published as Inside Job, and then that was picked up by another publisher and published as the book that's now currently available, The Terror Conspiracy. You can see how it all kind of flows together.
And comes up and culminates so far with SciSpies in 2007.
Right. We're finally getting the word out about remote viewing. And I will give you a heads up. I have a book in now to HarperCollins, and if it doesn't go the way of suppression and censorship, it'll be out next year, and we won't go into this one, but my working title is The Rise of the Fourth Reich.
In this country, I'm assuming.
Yes.
And its association with the historic Nazi past.
That's right, and I've heard this all the way back to the 60s and the hippies who were talking about fascism and America with a K, and I always thought that was just radical rhetoric, but when I did the research, I found that the very same people, companies, corporations that were behind Hitler are now running this country.
I believe that the same implications of some sort of obsession by Hitler with a blonde, blue-eyed super race and the observations by English intelligence of silver disks rising out of Panamunde in the 1920s has always fueled the question, was Hitler in association with some sort of a non-human group with advanced non-human technology?
Well, I actually addressed that, and here's some information that you may not be aware of. There's been many books written and movies made about the connection between the Nazis and occult practices, that they were heavily involved in the occult. Any science that's not clearly understood can be assumed to be magic or occultism. But during the 30s and into the war, within the German military was an umbrella organization simply known as Dr. Greenbaum or Dr. Greentree, apparently a reference to the tree of knowledge in the Garden of Eden. And within this Dr. Greenbaum was a group known as Magic, M-A-J-I-K. Apparently magic had to do with advanced propulsion technology, and of course I can't help but wonder if that was not brought over here and was the genesis for our Majestic 12 or Magic 12 as it was originally called, M-A-J-I-C, the group in the United States that's been in charge of sequestering and keeping control over UFO technology. But also under Dr. Greenbaum was psychic studies. In my new book, SciSpies, I was dealing strictly, or trying to deal strictly, with the U.S. Army's functional and operational group of military intelligence officers who were trained in the methodology of remote viewing. And let me make the distinction here. Remote viewing is not necessarily psychic ability. We all have psychic ability. Remote viewing was an attempt to control and bring on this psychic ability on demand through a structured series of protocols. And basically what it did, Linda, was allow the very psychic right hemisphere of the brain to communicate with the not at all psychic left hemisphere of the brain.
What I wondered is if you could explain the transition from what was experimentation at Stanford with Hal Puthoff and Russell Targ and Ingo Swann to a more formal program called ScanAid that was under the Central Intelligence Agency.
Well, let's go back to about 1970. A book was published called Psychic Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain, and it achieved some level of popularity, but it particularly rang alarm bells in the halls of Langley and in the halls of the Pentagon. Now, the attitude there was, we don't believe in this stuff, but if the commies are doing it, by God, we got to do it too. And so they begin to throw some money at psychic research simply as a reaction to studies that were being done behind the Iron Curtain. SCAN-8 simply was an acronym for scanning by coordinate. And they still use the term coordinates, but then it was actually longitude and latitude coordinates. And they would pick a random set of coordinates, have a viewer say, what's at this location? And for example, if the coordinates were for the North Pole and the viewer says, well, I see all white and it's cold and the wind's blowing and I see a bear and it's white, well, then, you know, they knew he was on target. But they moved away from that fairly rapidly, and they still use coordinates. In fact, there is a protocol called coordinate remote viewing. But coordinate is not a true coordinate. It's simply a set of numbers representing the target, because the problem, of course, is if I want you to go remote view the Eiffel Tower, if I tell you go remote view the Eiffel Tower, you've automatically got a picture of the Eiffel Tower because you've seen pictures, films, or you've been there. So you can't front load the viewer, and so they are given simply a set of numbers that represents the target. And then since at some point whoever wrote those numbers down knows what the target is, then psychically they're able to pick up from those target numbers the target, and if they're good, if they're practiced, they can actually go right to that target. So from there, they did all the experimentation out at Stanford Research Institute, and it was repetitive. It was over and over testing, over and over and over again. In fact, the remote viewing has been termed the most severely scientifically studied experiment in history. And I think that could be true, because there were literally hundreds of people involved in this. And for a period of years, it was just unremitting test, test, test. And what they finally did was prove that, yes, something was going on. And statistically, it went way above the law of averages on guessing. And so at this point, the CIA, who was already beginning to get in trouble because of assassination plots and drug running and a few other things, decided that they better get rid of anything that might cause them a public relations problem. And the Army was just standing there waiting to take over. So they said, we'll take it. And they moved it in the Intelligence and Security Command out of Fort Meade, Maryland. And that is where the original unit, which went through a variety of code names, Center Lane, Grill Flame, Stargate, Sunstreak, and that's where the Army's remote viewing unit started, and this is where they were using them operationally to go spy on potential enemies of the United States.
And that was in the 1980s?
That would have moved up into the late 1970s, and that persisted well on up into the 90s. By the early 1990s, the Defense Intelligence Agency had gotten involved and was also getting information. In fact, a lot of different agencies and organizations came to get information from the SciSpy unit. But according to them, the big problem is that nobody would ever take it seriously. When one of our CIA officers was kidnapped over in the Middle East, they were asked to find out where is he, and they did find out where he was, but nothing was done about it because of the mindset of the people in control, which is, well, Linda, you and I pretty much grew up in the same era that, you know, Apollo mission, Sputnik, space, science, technology, wow, you know, that was it. And basically we were conditioned that psychic ability is, and that's just strange, that's woo-woo, and that doesn't exist. And so it's been a tough climb getting over that, although recent advances in quantum mechanics and quantum physics tend to more and more show us that the entire universe is nothing but one big, huge mass of energy, and of which we're all part. And obviously, if someone has a thought, or if there's something existing in the universe, then it's on this universal energy grid. And if anyone is sensitive enough, psychic enough, if you will, intuitive, they can actually access the universal grid. And to me, that provides the framework for understanding how remote viewing works.
Remote viewing has demonstrated that it could find anything if applied correctly. Has it been applied to find Osama bin Laden?
Excellent question. And first, let me preface the response, which I think is going to raise your eyebrows, by saying that Osama bin Laden, who has been blamed by the government for being the mastermind and the instigator of the horrendous attacks on September 11th, 2001, has yet to be charged with anything. In fact, the FBI, on his wanted posters, do not even list 9/11 as one of the crimes that they want him for. And when asked about that, an FBI spokesman said, well, frankly, we don't have any hard evidence that he was behind 9/11. And that is the absolute gospel truth. No charges have been filed against him. And in fact, in mid-2002, not even a year before the first anniversary of 9/11, at a press conference, President Bush was asked about Osama bin Laden, and he said, and this is almost a direct quote, he said, well, we hadn't heard it from him in a while, and frankly, I'm not that concerned about him anymore.
But have you talked with any professional remote viewers who have talked to you off the record about looking for Osama bin Laden and saying this is where he is?
Okay. Can remote viewing locate Osama bin Laden? Absolutely, yes. A former trainer of the Army's remote viewing SciSpies unit was in New York on the morning of 9/11, and needless to say, was quite upset with what had happened. He told me personally that he contacted people deep within the government and told them, he said, you give me the word, I will locate Osama bin Laden. And he was told, no, 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 don't do that. We don't want that.
And when he said, why not, what did they say?
Well, he didn't ask them why not. He knew better, and they don't want bin Laden caught because bin Laden is the boogeyman they have to hold over our head to keep everybody fearful and divided and hence under tight control.
I understand that, and I would agree with that conclusion, but I am assuming that there are professional remote viewers who have tried to remote view where he is.
First, have to understand that there is no cohesive remote viewing unit anymore. So there's not one group that you could go to and say, go find him. It would be a variety of individuals. And whether they have individually gone out and tried to find Osama bin Laden, I'm just unaware of that.
Okay. Let's move to what I think is the most fascinating part of your book. It is called The Enigma File.
Right. I think the reason they had to suppress my book was because after laying a very credible foundation for the science and history of remote viewing, I then went into the Enigma files, which basically is that every single one of these military government-trained remote viewers at one time or another had direct personal knowledge of UFOs.
Yes.
That's what they could not allow to get out in a credible manner.
Ingo Swann told me about his own personal experience in the Pentagon of doing a remote viewing target that was only latitude and longitude. And when he began to draw, it was a submarine that had a disc over or to the side of the submarine.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was asked by the military authority sitting across from him at a desk, you can't mean a UFO, and that Ingo responded, yes, I do. At that moment, they gathered up the paper, the pencils. Everybody left the room, leaving Ingo sitting there by himself.
That's right. That's right. That is a good illustration, actually, of several things. He was not tasked to go see a UFO. He was tasked to go see a submarine. And yet, when he went and viewed the submarine and there was a UFO nearby, obviously his attention was drawn to the UFO. And this is why each and every one of these SciSpies had personal knowledge of the UFOs. I have been told, and I assume that this is true, that they were never at any time tasked to go look at UFOs. Now, Linda, that only makes sense because how could the government, which for 60 years has tried to tell us that there is no such thing, order their official remote viewers to go look at something that they say doesn't exist? But when they went out looking for other things, for example, if they were tasked to go and look in the upper atmosphere for high performance and high flying aircraft to see what what the Russians or the Chinese or somebody might be testing. They would go up there, they'd see these things flitting through the atmosphere, and they go take a mental look at them. And as one remote viewer told me, they weren't us and they weren't the Russians. He said those guys weren't even from the neighborhood.
And now I would like to share a confirming section of the history on remote viewing that comes from Jim's book, and it's about Captain Frederick Skip Atwater. He was former operations and training officer for the Psi Spies unit. And back in February of 1998, after the government acknowledged that there was this unit working for the Army and that it had previously worked as Scan 8 for the CIA, Captain Atwater spoke at the 7th Annual International UFO Congress in Nevada. Atwater, who was awarded the Meritorious Service Medal for his work within the Psychic Remote Viewing Unit, and went on to become research director for the Monroe Institute, which was teaching how to get the brain to work and go out of the body. He stunned his audience, which included Jim Mars at that time in 1998, by announcing that a Psi Spies study had confirmed previous reports of four separate alien, meaning non-human, bases on this Earth. Captain Atwater told the audience that he became a training officer for the Psi Spies in the mid-1980s and was ordered to test the government-trained remote viewers by presenting them challenging targets. So during one formal but unofficial session, as with the Enigma probes described by Morehouse and Mel Riley, Captain Atwater sent unit members to look at the four bases described by another remote viewer, Pat Price. And when I use the verb sent, that means to remote view. To Captain Atwater's amazement, this remote viewing session, which had been described as a test, utilized strict RV protocols and confirmed Pat Price's account and even added more details about these underground bases and operations by non-humans. What was even more amazing to the attendees of this conference was that this incredible confirmation by an absolute government authority who had served in our military was about alien bases on Earth, and that the speaker was a decorated military intelligence officer. And yet, none of this was covered by any news media. We only know because Jim Mars was there and has reported it in this extremely important new 2007 book, Psi Spies, The True Story of America's Psychic Warfare Program. And next week, Whitley, I'll be back to help share about how remote viewing has also been applied to our solar system with astonishingly correct results before scientists have been able to confirm the data, and that I have come up with a news scoop because of remote viewing.
Well, Linda, that's going to be tremendously exciting. Wait for it, folks. This has been Whitley Strieber's Dreamland. Thanks very much for listening. We'll be back next week with another journey to the extreme edge of controversy on Dreamland. Do not miss it.